I need somebody
help,
not just anybody
help.
You know I need someone
help.
When I was younger, so much younger than today,
I never needed
anybody's help in any way.
But now these days are gone,
I'm not so self-assured.
Now I find, I've
changed my mind
and open up the doors.
Beatles, of course, help. And we all need a bit of help in life, don't we? And tonight is all about help, people helping each other. A fellowship of people, Alcoholics Anonymous, who come together to give up and to share their own experiences and to try and stay sober just one day at a time, just for today. Let's stay sober just for today. Let's try and keep on the right path. And we're going to meet some incredible people tonight, six people to bring to your attention, with varying degrees of sobriety between them. Interested in your thoughts tonight. If you've anything to say about anything that you hear, or if you've got an experience you'd like to share or a thought you'd like to share, you can give us a call. Totally free, 0800 7833 583. 0800 7833 583. Andy will be standing by to take your call. You can drop us a text, 81333, start your message with the word LANKS. That will cost you a standard message rate if you text that to 81333. Or you can WhatsApp us for free, completely free of charge. Again, start your message with the word LANKS and send it to 08000, that's 08000 321333. 08000 321333. Interested in your thoughts, whatever you've got to say tonight. Let's meet our first couple of people. Let's meet John and let's meet Wendy. Welcome, John. Welcome, Wendy.
Hi, Gary.
Now then, thanks for being here. We'll talk to you first, John, if we can, because your story is quite interesting. You're a Navy veteran.
Yeah, it's the first time I've considered myself to be a Navy veteran. I was in the Navy for 7 years.
Right. Well, that's longer than I were. I did no service at all. So you're a vet. That'll
right,
do.
Okay.
Why did you join the Navy? Well, that's quite interesting. Rather than the Army or the Air Force.
Right. The reason I joined the Navy was to get away, to run away, basically. At 16, I came home drunk to my mother's house. I put the chip pan on and was woke up by the fire brigade as the house burnt down.
You know, it's such a common thing. I've got a friend who did the same, but with sausages under a grill. He just forgot to take them out of the packet.
Well, it wasn't so much taking it out of the packet. I'd just taken a lot of alcohol out of the packet first. That's what caused the fire.
Yeah.
But I woke up in hospital. Thankfully, it was just smoke inhalation that was damaged. And the regret, the remorse, the shame that built up in me was unbearable. My mother had brought me and my brother up on her own. And she'd done a hell of a job. She'd worked hard. She'd done two jobs. And I'd just burnt her house down. And all I wanted to do at that moment in time was to go home and help. I felt terrible. But the only thing that I could do that would take away that feeling of guilt, remorse and shame, enable me to be able to do something, was to go for a drink. So you can well imagine, Gary, I've just burnt my mother's house down and I turn up from the hospital with drink inside me again. You know, so the reason for me joining the Navy was certainly not an intellectual decision based upon my career. It was one where I needed to get away. And I thought the Navy would be a fresh start for me. So I joined the Navy at 17 and off I went. And that, it didn't turn out much better than before I set off to the Navy, to be perfectly honest.
I was going
to
say, there is sort of a naval tradition that sailors are known to be big drinkers.
Yes.
Sort of, I don't know how much truth there is in that, but that's certainly the perception of them. But it's interesting that you were so drunk at 16 to be, you know, burning houses down and things like that. When did you take your first drink? When...
My first proper drink was at 13. My stepfather had a building business and he used to give his lads bonuses on a Friday in the form of crates of beer, bottles of whiskey, etc. And I saw one of these crates of beer at 13 and thought, that sounds like a, that looks like a good idea. So one of those crates of beer mysteriously vanished from where it was and appeared in the bowling green where me and my mates went down and started drinking. The strange thing was that instantaneously I sensed a feeling of relief, a feeling of being at ease, a feeling that I'd never sensed before. Every anxiety, every worry, every stress just disappeared, literally went. Alcohol, even at the age of 13, changed my entire perception of the reality that I was living in. Now, I know that that didn't happen to the other guys because the next day, mysteriously, another crate of beer disappeared.
Yeah.
I went to my friends and said, I've got some beer, lads. I've got some beer down at the bowling green. And they said, yeah, we'll have a game of football and then we'll go down there, John. I said, no, you haven't heard me. I've got a crate of beer. She said, yeah, we'll have a game. So why football? See, what it did for me, it didn't do for them.
That's really interesting because quite often talking to people, you talk about the first drink and they didn't even like the stuff. They didn't like the taste. But they carried on drinking and sort of acquired a taste for it rather than thinking it was delicious from the get-go.
Yes.
So is it the case, do you think, that some people are predisposed to, you know, drink does something to them, that it in a way it doesn't do it to, you know, Bob outside of him?
I think definitely there can be a predisposition to it. Now, whether or not that predisposition to being an alcoholic ends up you being an alcoholic, it depends on various things, I believe. And I think a lot of those are social, a lot of those are in the family home, the things that are going on. I mean, for an example, I won a full scholarship to a private school at the age of 10.
Right.
And that scared the life out of me. A couple of reasons.
Why scared?
Well, a few reasons. One was that I was brought up on a council estate. A posh school, a private school, there's not going to be many kids there from a council estate. Mm. We didn't have a phone, we didn't have a car. Mother was a single parent, and it scared the life out of me. Plus, also, I didn't think I was worthy of it. That was the truth of it. I didn't. And people, but I managed to talk my mother out of sending me there. And it was even from the age of 10, that anxiety, the stress, the worry. And at that age, you were sort of taught that you didn't wash your linen in public.
Mm.
You kept it to yourself. You didn't open up about worries, fears, stresses, anxieties.
Yeah.
You kept it internal. Now, what happened was I would walk around with this, and especially with being brought up on a council estate, you didn't show fear on a council estate. If you did, you'd be gobbled up. So I learnt to project an image out to the people around me that was one of being in control, being a tough lad, don't mess with it. And really, it was to stop you getting through to seeing what I was like.
I know exactly what you're talking about because I had exactly the same upbringing, although I had a mum and dad, weren't a single parent. But they're tough places, and if you don't want to be eaten, you've got to be tough. Whether you're tough really or not doesn't matter. You've got to walk the walk.
You've got to keep that pretense going. And it's to keep people at bay. My first form of defence was attack.
Mm.
You know, I'd been the witness to and the victim of domestic violence for quite a number of years, and none of that got out. None of that was... You didn't speak about things like that.
No.
But all of that was in me from a very, very early age.
So as a young boy, you're carrying this around with you. You find drink drink almost like opens the magic portal and things feel better.
Well, yeah, but,
sort of.
Well, yeah, sort of. But to me, there was nothing abnormal. At that age, it was just my life. It right. wasn't. I didn't think that I'd been dealt a bad hand. I didn't think that other people had a better life than me. This was just my life, and it's the way I felt. Now, I didn't know any other way of feeling. This was just the way I was. It's the way I felt, the way I conducted myself. It was only when I drank that I realised that there was another way to feel. There was another way to view the world. There was another perception that I could adopt where, for the first time in my life, my outsides matched my insides. And by that, I mean that in my normal life, I would feel scared, I would feel anxious, I would feel under stress. Now, I couldn't articulate those emotions at that age. Not. Looking back in hindsight, that's how I felt on the inside. On the outside, I was John Wayne.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the image that I would put across. When I drank, I no longer had to pretend because I felt like that on the inside. So did I prefer being sober or did I prefer having a drink? I preferred having a drink.
No doubt. I can see the sort of advantage of that. I can see the desirability of that if it matched up those feelings. Wendy, what about your story? How similar or is your story very different to John's? What about your first drink?
Well, my first real drink. I mean, my family had this view, which obviously didn't work out in my case, that if you had a little bit of drink, you know, you've heard that theory with the dinner, with a Sunday dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. As you know, from about the age of 11.
So you don't make it a forbidden fruit, but you make it, look, it's part of life and it's just normal.
Then you'll be used to it by the time you start drinking proper as an adult and you won't have problems. But my first real drink, I guess, was when I went to a party. It was only next door. I was 17. I didn't drink much before then because I went to boarding school. So I was 17 and I had massive social anxiety. And someone gave me a drink and I thought, oh, it's gone. I know what, I better have another one. Then I had another one. And because I hadn't drunk that amount before, I was then completely drunk. I had to go home. I had to walk up and down for 2 hours. My brother's holding me up before my parents got home. So that was my first experience. And in a way, that set the scene because it was a solution for me for stress in the same way. But it also, I guess I knew I had to control it.
Yeah.
So I started straight away thinking, right, there's this magic bullet. But obviously you can't have too much of it. Otherwise you feel rubbish and you start falling down drunk. So how am I going to do this?
So you were trying to work out how to have your quarter, if you will, and how to get the benefits that you felt, the good things, but without the hangover, the stumbling, the not being able to function, perhaps?
Yes.
Okay.
And basically, I spent the next 40 years trying to do that to a greater or lesser extent and with greater or lesser success at various times.
That begs a question because I know you were working.
Yeah, you know? I was a solicitor.
So that being a solicitor is, I would imagine, a high-pressure environment sometimes. I imagine there are cases, I don't know what your specialty were, but sometimes there'll be cases that might be stressful or need a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And you see solicitors on TV, you see this, we see everybody on TV, oh, what a stressful day, plonk the wine, there we go. And it's the default setting. This glass will make it all better and take all the stress away. Mm-hmm. Did it have that effect for you or was it like a wrecking ball? I mean, how does a solicitor, someone with such a responsible job, presumably having to appear in court before the bench and everything, and make sense of the world, how do you spin that plate while you drink, while you're drinking?
So I fairly soon realised, I fairly soon realised I couldn't drink at work, that somebody smelt my breath. I was referred to HR. Ah. I, of course, denied it totally, as you would.
And what were you drinking at that point? What was your weapon of choice?
I think I was probably either drinking vodka neat or wine at work.
Right.
So I thought, I'm not going to get away with this twice, am I?
Mm.
So I thought, all right, I won't drink at work. But believe me, the second I clocked off, I ran into the nearest off licence. And, you know, I'd be drinking before I'd even started driving home.
Wow.
And if I, you know, it's crazy, really, because I even had to go down to London. I maybe gave a talk to a parliamentary committee. I would go back to Euston Station. Before I got on the train, I would need to buy some alcohol. And I would think to myself, I'm only going to get one. It was always that. I just need to calm my nerves. Just
the one.
Just the one. I'll sit on this bench outside Euston in a little square there is there. I will cover up the tin so nobody can see. They might think it's a tin of Coke, but actually it's vodka and Coke. But then, of course, it's hard to explain this. But then when it starts going out of your system, you want more. So I'd be on the train back to Manchester and I'd be going to the buffet car. And he would say to me, why don't you get the bigger bottle? It's actually a lot cheaper in the long run.
Yeah. So then you might say, well, I'm saving myself money. Well, that's the choice.
Yes.
The right choice. Do you know, I don't mean to be flippant, it would be Johnny Smartpants, but I'm like that with Jaffa Cakes. And if I open a packet of Jaffa Cakes...
Yes.
I can't have what the packet goes. There's something about Jaffa Cakes that I genuinely... And I sit there with an empty packet... feeling sick as a pig and having buyer's remorse, thinking, I really shouldn't have done that. I don't mean to be flippant, but I imagine it's the same sort of thing. I'll just have the one. You have more, and then you think, why did I do that? Is there a parallel, a Jaffa Cake parallel?
I think the parallel probably is that I was chasing some peace of mind. That's all I wanted, you know, to stop this washing machine head that was driving me insane.
Yeah.
And I'd have one drink and maybe at two drinks, that would have been enough. But for an alcoholic, which I didn't realise I was at all, let me just say that, you then can't stop. So you cannot stop at the station, which is nice and mellow, and put the bottle back in the fridge like most people. I'm going to carry on. And the difference between Jaffa Cakes and alcohol is it's going to change my personality. I don't suppose that you suddenly start shouting at your partner or drink driving or taking risky behaviour that you wouldn't normally do.
No.
When you've had a few Jaffa Cakes.
No.
And that's the real problem. I mean, it wasn't just destroying myself. It's the damage it does to the people around me.
This is the thing, and I've spoken to so many people in recovery over the years doing this programme and in other avenues, and part of the regret, a lot of the regret, isn't always for themselves. It's for those people that they hurt, John, along the way. And I guess you'd feel the same. There'll be people that you'd want to...
It is, and the thing is, that regret or the remorse or the shame that builds up, that leads back to another drink. Because again, if alcohol was going to change my perception, which it did for a long time until it stopped working, it would. I could walk into a bar and I'd hate everyone. Four pints later, I want you to be the best man and I want to go to Barbados with you. It changed my entire perception of reality completely. So when when it hits the fan and everything goes wrong, and I've hurt the people who I love, and I see that, and I certainly did not intend to do that, that guilt, remorse and shame wells up. And a perfect example of that was with my first partner. We had a child, Connor. He was 6 years old. And eventually, she'd had enough of me, and she left. Now, I watched the car drive away, and my son, Connor, looking out of the back window of that car with confusion on his face. Where's Dad going? Why is he not coming with us? Mm. What's happening? What's going on? Now, I knew that it was alcohol that was taking that boy away. And I swore there and then, the same emotions you're talking about, the guilt, the remorse and shame, I swore I would never drink another drop of alcohol as long as I live. And if you put me on a lie detector test, I have passed. half an hour later, I have drink in hand. Because that guilt, that remorse, that shit, the self-loathing and hatred that welled up inside me, there was only one thing I knew that would take that away. And I'm in the pub with a drink, and 3 pints later, I've gone from I don't know what to do to, oh, I know what to do. Now, it's not, because I'm now thinking with a drunken mind, a drunken head. My brain chemistry has changed.
Yeah.
I mean, I would do it so many times. I'd write down ideas at night drunk, going, this is what I'm going to do. This, yeah, number one, number two, number three. And I'd wake up in the morning and see 17 points there and think, who wrote that?
Really?
Because there was that much of a shift in my thinking from that. So, yes, although you would think the guilt, the remorse and the shame and the things you do to hurt others will be enough to stop you from drinking, in actual fact, that is the catalyst for more drink. And that's why with a lot of our things that we do within AA, yes, come in and let's get hooked up and try and help someone and put down that first drink and stay away from one drink for one day. But now let's look at the underlying causes of the first drink.
Yeah.
Because unless you go to the underlying causes, to stay away from that first drink is going to be harder and harder and harder. So it's not just a talking therapy, as has been mentioned. Mm. There's much more involved with this. I mean, if you were to go to a doctor and the doctor said to you, you've got a life-threatening illness, which alcoholism is. Mm. OK, doc, what should I do? I want you to go in that room over there and talk to those five people. Right, and what next? Just keep talking. Yeah, but what next? Well, we do have a what next.
Right.
We have a 12-step program of recovery.
Yeah.
And that is what looks at the underlying causes. You know, if you were to walk past the door here and you catch your leg on the jamb every time because there's a big nail that's sticking out,
yeah.
You can keep putting a plaster on your leg and you can keep saying, I'll dodge that nail. Or you can say, do you know what? Let's get the nail out the door,
Take
Casey.
Get the nail out the door. It makes sense to fix.
To get to the underlying reason things. Why we drink. Now, if you were to ask virtually any active alcoholic, why do you drink? There may be a million and one reasons that come out. But the honest to God truth is we don't know.
No.
We honestly do not know. Like when I came to AA, I could not articulate myself the way I can now. I could not describe the emotions I felt at the time. But what I could do, I sat in meetings thinking, that's how I feel. That's that there.
Identifying elements of what yes. your experience
and those
were.
First few meetings I went to, I was under the impression that AA was a secret organisation that had gone out and done its research on me because these buggers knew a lot more about me than I did.
I want to talk about the steps. I want to talk about what is on offer and how it changed both of your lives. We'll take a break for, again, the songs tonight. We've chosen some songs that we hope will be appropriate. And this is a lady who had her own demons, Amy Winehouse and Rehab. It's BBC Radio Lancashire. It's 10 to 8. It's your Lancashire.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, I gained got 17 days.
Amy Winehouse on BBC Radio Lancashire. It's 8 minutes to 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 17th of November, and it's your Lancashire, and it's our annual look into the world of recovery with Alcoholics Anonymous to commemorate their Alcohol Awareness Month. We've done this a few times now, when we always bring interesting people to you. Just to let you know, there'll be no news at 8 or 9 tonight. If you need to look at the headlines, you can feel free to jump online at bbc.co.uk. All the news there for you. News will resume at 10, but we're going to continue our conversations. Just want to say hello to Sarah, who's been in touch. I'm in AA, and I heard of this programme via my morning meditation meeting. Fabulous of you to bring awareness to this. My name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. Sarah, thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of the show tonight. It's not us they're doing it. It's good people like John and Wendy who've joined us in the studio. And Wendy, when we spoke to you last, we left you on the bench outside Euston Station disguising a can of drink as maybe a can of Coke or what have you, and learning all these sneaky ways to disguise what you were doing. You'd already had the rule of law read out at work because they smelled drink on your breath, and you thought, okay, I'll not drink at work, but you didn't have to make up for it when
I got home.
You got home to not put too fine a point on it. Quick question. If you could control it at work, could you not have applied the same rule at home? Just popped into my mind there.
Well, no, I mean, the truth is I couldn't. Right. Because while I was at work, I was a workaholic as well. I think I was just pushing reality away through work. But the second I was out of there, the first thing that came in my head was a drink. And the thing was, it wasn't till I got to AA, I realised that, you know, I was abusive to my husband when I got home and lost my temper. And then I used to ring him up in the morning at work, so sorry, swearing, yeah, I'm never going to drink again. I gave up loads of times, you know, 2 weeks, a month, once for a whole year, but I just couldn't keep it up. And the thing was that I promised him I'd stop drinking, and I did, but of course I couldn't keep it up, so I was hiding it around the house. I didn't want to disappoint him, and then he would find it and pour it away. And at that point, I started to blame him for my drinking, which sounds crazy, but I thought to myself, if he would let me renege on my promise not to drink at home, then I wouldn't have to be drinking the second I leave my office and while I'm commuting in my car back home. So on an empty stomach, and we all know we get drunk on an empty stomach, so I basically started to blame my husband.
Is that, obviously, you'll have heard shares from many, many people in meetings. Mm-hmm. Is that a common thing?
Yes.
Is that something that people do, just look to shoulder the blame? Well, it's not me, it's him. It's not me, it's this situation. It's not me.
Yeah.
Is it fairly common?
It's hard to explain that alcohol distorts our thinking. So it's completely irrational. I mean, I poured it down my neck. Yes, everybody, nearly everybody at the meeting shares something similar about it was their childhood, it was bullying at work, you know. But in the end, what we all now say is, but I poured it down my neck, nobody else did.
Yeah, you've got to lift the glass, you've got to buy the stuff, you've got to walk into the pub, you've got to, these are very conscious decisions that your feet don't just take you there. You've got to be willing and think you steer the good ship and, you know, into the pub, I guess. So how do you get from that bench with that can of Coke to walking through the doors of AA?
Well, I tried everything. I tried hypnotherapy, some kind of magnetism, counselling. And eventually it was when my cousin told me that my husband said our marriage was on the rocks. I couldn't believe it, but I knew I had to do something. And my pride hadn't let me up till then. I just couldn't, I didn't want to go crawling for help to some alkies, you know.
Because this is a successful woman, you're good at what you do, you're held in high regard at work, you're a workaholic, as you say, so you're smashing it at work, and it's brilliant. So you thought you were a bit above that, perhaps?
Correct. Okay. I thought I was too intelligent, too self-reliant,
yeah.
And if, you know, I would be able to crack this one day on my own.
You don't need a bunch of wasters in a room, because we all have this thing, we all have this picture from TV, we spoke about this before on the programme, John, that it's a bunch of people in chairs huddled together and they're all of a certain type, and this is the media, and I blame the BBC as much as anybody. This is the portrayal of AA meetings, drafty holes with pathetic individuals huddled in a chair, and they're all of a certain type, and it couldn't be further from the truth, could it?
Well, no, it couldn't. But at the same time, you couldn't describe an AA meeting accurately, because it'd be a bit like me asking you to describe a pub.
Right.
You know, they all have something in common. Yes, they sell alcohol, but yeah, they're all different. They all have the different personalities. They've got the different regulars who go there. And that's the same with AA. You know, there are different themes for the meetings. The way in which the meetings are run, you read out the preamble at the start, and most meetings will start with that preamble. But how that meeting then goes forward is down to the meeting and how they run the meeting. Some will be, they might be, you've mentioned the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous there. Some will be a Big Book study meeting, as they call it, where they will go through and try and study the contents of the book. Some will be main share meetings where people will share their experience, strength and hope for 40 minutes or so. Others will be an open meeting with the share. We did a meeting a few years ago in Blackburn where it was conversation with a drunk, where we got one of the members up and then one of us would ask him questions rather than him giving his experience. And that way we could formulate the questions for the newcomers who just arrived to try and squash some of the myths you're talking about here. So there is no definitive AA meeting on how it goes. Now, you will find some people who will say, well, AA is not for me. Well, let me just correct you on that. AA is for everyone, but some people don't think they are for AA. It's the other way around. Now, we always say, you know, try a few meetings, come along. What have you got to lose? Absolutely nothing. There are no dues or no fees, as was heard in the preamble.
Yeah, free.
Now, at the same time, when you come to that first meeting, obviously you're not there because you broke a fingernail. You're there for a serious reason, and you're going to be fearful, you're going to be stressed, you're going to be worried. What are they going to be like? Who are they going to tell? Are they going to tell anyone that I'm here? All these fears coming. So for most people, don't really remember much about the first meeting, apart from the fact that, thank God I got through that.
Yeah.
You know. So you can't really define it. But what I always say is, if you were drinking and you went in a pub and you didn't like that pub and you didn't like the people who were going in there, you didn't like the music that was being played and you got a bad pint, did you stop going to every pub?
No, of course.
No, you went to the next one down the road. Yeah.
So this feeling that you were sort of above this, Wendy, you obviously had to take drastic action and think, okay, we're going to give AA a whirl. Do you remember your first meeting? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember it well. I cried all the way through with humiliation at having to be there. But I was so relieved, because before that, I thought I was a freak. I mean, everyone else I knew, however heavily they drunk, they could actually decide not to. Yeah. They could put the bottle back in the fridge, and I couldn't. So I was really relieved. And I also saw people who said they'd quit drinking, and there was a light in their eyes. They looked contented, and I wanted it.
You wanted a bit of that?
Yep.
Yeah, so presumably you kept on going.
I kept going, and I did really everything that I was asked to do. Got a sponsor, started doing the steps. And after 3 months, after my first meeting, I can remember waking up one morning and the sun was coming over the window ledge, and I felt this unfamiliar feeling in my stomach. And then I thought, it's hope. Finally, hope.
Wow. And that's what you got from those meetings. And that probably the nicest feeling that didn't come out of a bottle.
Yes.
I suppose, in a manner of speaking. Again, I'm not trying to be Johnny Smartypants, but you've got to replace one thing with another, surely, otherwise it won't work. And you replaced it with that wonderful feeling, that great feeling of hope that here we go.
Yes, you know? I mean, at the beginning, of course, many people find it very difficult to sleep. You quit when you quit drinking. And we're still left with the fear that has been described, and anxiety that we started drinking for. But the amazing thing about the program is, one, being able to, we don't have small talk. We don't say, oh, you've got nice hair today. Somebody asks you how you are and you say, I've been made to feel so angry, because we can't feel angry, because that might make us drink. So we can tell people the most ridiculous things that made us angry or upset.
So you can really get it all off your chest and really sort of scream into the void and really not do any damage. You know, all those little things that in life drive you crazy.
And then we start laughing, because really, most of the trivial things that drive us mad are quite funny, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. We get annoyed at crazy things that in the end don't really matter, I suppose, some of them. John, we left you watching your little boy get smaller and smaller as he drove away. And you thought, that's it. Mm-hmm. And then within half an hour, you'd have drink in your hand. There will be many, many people listening who would think, look, if that were me, I'd kick the drink right away, and that'd be, and I'd do anything I could to get my little lad back. So why are you different?
Right, well, you're right, and the emotions that I had were exactly how you've just described them, because my eldest son lost his father 6 years. He didn't see me for 6 years from then, and I did everything apart from dress up as Spider-Man and climb buildings, actually, but I didn't wear the outfit. I'd been to AA. At my first meeting wasn't exactly the same. After my first meeting, I went home and my partner said, what was it like? I said, oh, it was really good. Really good. He said, yeah. I said, well, what have they told you to do? I said, well, you know, certain things. Yeah, but what's the main thing? And I just didn't have it, because I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to go by. I said, oh, they've just told me I have to smoke plenty of weed and I'll be absolutely fine.
Simple as that.
Well, that was what... I mean, they hadn't told me that, obviously. They'd make that clear straight away. But you see, the thought of going through life with the head that I had and the contents of it I couldn't even go there. Now, with my son at that point, he'd never really seen anything bad going on, but I fully understand and respect his mother's decision for leaving. And I did try everything, but I had no parental responsibilities, so unfortunately I had no rights. And I couldn't see him for 6 years. And in that 6 years, I nosedived into a depression I never thought I'd get out of. Now, for me, from my first meeting, which was before she'd left, it was 12 years until my last drink. And for 12 years, I bounced in and out of AA, where I'd come back, I'd be very disappointed that it was the same faces who were still there, because I wanted them all to have gone back on the drink to justify what had happened to me. And it was a bit like you were talking about earlier with these things that happen, you give them reasons. This is why I'm drinking. So I could give the reason of my son there. I haven't seen him for 6 years. I could give the... Now, all these things contribute towards the fact of me taking the first drink, yes. But taking the first drink and using drink as a way of overcoming a issue in your life is not alcoholism. For instance, I had a friend who came to me, a neighbour, once, and he said, John, he said, I think I'm an alcoholic. Can we have a word? And I said, well, you're probably not then.
No.
He said, well, what do you mean? I'm not. I said, you're probably not an alcoholic. I said, are you having problems in your life right now? He said, yeah, we're having some issues at home with a wife. I said, so you're drinking to get over them? He said, yeah. I said, well, sort your issues out and you'll be fine. He said, well, why do you say I'm not an alcoholic? I said, because if you were an alcoholic, you'd be fighting tooth and nail to prove to me that you're not an alcoholic, to justify the fact you can carry on drinking. And isn't it strange how justify sounds like just a lie? Odd that, isn't it?
Never thought of that. Never thought of that.
So all these emotions you're talking about, see, you're looking at the outside, and what you're not seeing is the inside. The inside that can't cope with the reality of life, that can't cope with the everyday pressures of life for whatever reason. It doesn't really matter. I mean, some people say, well, I drink because of this, 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 and this. And some people will say, no, you drink because you're an alcoholic. Rubbish. He starts drinking because of all those issues in his life. He can't stop drinking because he's an alcoholic. There's a big difference in that. And there's a big difference between a hard drinker and an alcoholic. See, for me, I drank and I could integrate into life. Without it, I couldn't. The social anxiety that you mentioned there, I'm pretty sure that social anxiety was something I carried with me from a very early age. I didn't know it was social anxiety.
No.
It was just a feeling.
Couldn't label
it. But again,
the
experience I got, and I use this analogy, my ex-wife, she's not an alcoholic and she's not an addict. If she was to meet you and she doesn't like you, she'll take a few drinks and, well, she still won't like you.
Right.
find that pretty bizarre myself, because I would meet someone, I don't like him, I take a few drinks and I want to go to Barbados and have babies with them, because it just altered my thinking. So now when you look at that in the reality of the daylight, I've got a life that I find unbearable, but when I drink, it is bearable. Now you then say to me, stop drinking. And I go, okay, I stop drinking and I go back to an unbearable life. Right. And as you rightly said, I need something to replace that. And I've always said from day one that if being sober is no better than drinking, I'm going back drinking.
Okay, so
there'll be no ifs and buts.
When did you discover that being sober is way better than drinking?
The first time, it was 3 months in and I'd had a day from hell. Everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. And it was only the following day I realised I hadn't thought about a drink. I thought, wow. And that's where the word hope that came in. But that's not what has kept me within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and gives me the drive to want to stay sober. The real feeling was when I reached out to help another... Well, no, I didn't reach out to help another individual. An individual reached out to me to help them within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Scared the life out of me. What am I going to do? I don't know what I'm doing with this guy. I haven't got a clue. But I was willing to try and help. Now, then I became a small part of his recovery. And I saw him get better. I saw him get back with his wife. I saw him get back with his children. I became godparent to one of his children. The feelings that I've had that have been generated by helping another individual are better than any drink or drug I ever took. Now, it's still selfish in a way, because, and I'll be honest with you, I've had days where I've had those bad days and it's all gone wrong. And I've walked out the door going, right, I'm off to help someone at a meeting tonight. Whether they want it or not, they're getting some help tonight. Why? Because it helps me.
And that keeps you on the straight and narrow. How long is it since you've had a drink?
It's over 17 years now.
That's some achievement. That's from what you've said and from where you were.
Yeah, and the thing,
incredible achievement.
As I said as well, it was 12 years between my first meeting and my last drink. Because I've no doubt there's some people who are going to listen to this who've gone, I've tried AA, it didn't work.
Mm.
Right? Now, I have questions for people who do that, who come into the meetings and go, oh, I've tried AA. I said, all right, okay, so you got yourself a sponsor? No. You tried the 12-step program? No. You got yourself a home group? No. You attended regular meetings? No. I said, well, you haven't tried AA.
Yeah,
then,
you haven't really.
You can't say it hasn't worked.
You haven't really done it.
No, you haven't.
You haven't walked the walk.
I'll be honest, the only reason, the 12-step program of recovery that's detailed within the book, and it is the main source of recovery, there is one reason and one reason only I undertook that. There's one reason only I got a sponsor and that I did the program, was to prove it wouldn't work.
So in trying to pull the system down, actually you found the system works.
Correct.
That's brilliant. We've asked everybody to choose a song that means something to them for tonight, and your song choice is a beautiful song. It's one of my favourites. Tell us what it is and tell us why it means so much to you. It's a beautiful song by Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel.
Oh, I Never Give Up. Yeah.
Don't Give Up. And it's a gorgeous. You might remember the video. It's kind of, there's an eclipse and they're just holding on to each other.
The main reason that I picked that is I thought it would go better than I'm H-A-P-P-Y.
There's no answer to that, John. Let's hear this beautiful song, which does have a message, don't give up. It's incredible. And if this is making sense to you when you're looking at that glass and you don't want to look at it anymore, don't give up. There is help. We'll talk about how you can contact AA in a little while. Enjoy this song. It's a beautiful, beautiful song.
In this proud land we grew up strong. We were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name, but no one wants you when you lose.
Don't give up, 'cause you have friends. Don't give up, you're not beaten yet. Don't give up, I know you.
thought that I could be a fainting, thought that we'd be last to go. It is so strange the way things turn. Drove the night toward my home, the place that I was born, on the lakeside. As daylight broke, I saw the earth, the trees had burned down to the ground.
Don't give up, you still have us. Don't give up, we don't need much of anything. Don't give up, 'cause somewhere there's a place where we belong. Rest your head, you worry too much.
It's your Lancashire, and it's our special for Alcohol Awareness Month, where we link up with Alcoholics Anonymous East Lancashire and talk to some incredible people. We've been talking to John and Wendy, and Wendy, you know, we mentioned the fact that you thought that AA were beneath you. You got over that, and you went, and you tried it out, and it worked, and we left you with that lovely bubble of hope. That yes. You had in your tummy, that kind of woke up and you had this wonderful feeling that there was hope. You came to recognise that as hope.
Yes.
And presumably that carried on, otherwise you wouldn't have kept on going to AA. How did your life change from that sort of moment?
I mean, my life began to change because I learnt some things that really I wish I'd learnt at school. Well, the first one, it should be obvious, is I'm not in control of the universe. So, you know, I was taught by my parents to be very competitive.
Right.
And there's a healthy competitiveness, but I guess there's an unhealthy competitiveness. And that played out even with my family and my friends. And I had a perfectionism as well. So everything had to be just right, and particularly me. So when I arrived at AA, I detested myself. Mm. I let myself down, but I hated myself.
You're a failure. You felt that...
I felt an imposter, even though I'd done really well in my career. Yeah, it's amazing the difference between the mask, the front that you put on, and the gap behind that is so painful, being this cringing person behind it. And what happened in AA through going to the steps is the two became the same thing, if that makes sense. I didn't have to pretend anymore to be someone else.
You mentioned that you were able to get things off your chest and all those silly things that, you know, you might want to tell other people, but you could just come into this room and people were genuinely interested to ask how you were.
So I started to have real trust in people for the first time ever. Yeah. And then all my relationships have got better, not just, you know, obviously in AA, but my relationships outside AA. I've got a daughter, she's 28, fantastic relationship with her, and my relationship with my husband, of course, which was quite cold when I was drinking.
To ask, because you did mention about your husband said that your marriage was on the rocks. I were looking for a ginger way to gingerly ask about that, but are you still... I'm going to come out with you now. Are you still together?
Yes.
Brilliant.
I mean, and not only are we still together, but we have a completely different type of relationship. He no longer has to walk on eggshells around me. And although I occasionally get a little bit shirty, let's call it, I no longer go off into a red mist rage fueled by alcohol and start saying, right, I'm off to Scotland, give me the effing keys and all that. I don't behave that way anymore.
But we all get irritated. We all... There are things that get under his skin and we all have arguments, but what you're saying is it's your normal, average, everyday argument rather than fueled by the anger that alcohol puts inside you, that sort of fire, I suppose.
Yes, and I think as well as that, you know, the 12 steps, one of the things is learning some humility. One of them is just because I think something should be a certain way doesn't mean that's the right way. Right. There are many ways to make 11, 8 and 3, 4 and 7. This is a kind of thing that I've learnt in AA. It's been invaluable, honestly.
And you've let go of the perfectionism, the need to try and spin the universe your way.
Yeah. And, you know, without the foggy brain, I could never work out what was wrong with my relationships, because if as soon as a problem cropped up with somebody, I just obliterate it and go into oblivion with half a bottle of vodka, I feel so awful the next day. There's no chance of me trying to work out. No. And basically, I blame them. I think, well, whatever they've done, they've wrecked me now. I've had to poison myself to get past the pain of what they did. I never, ever had a sensible, rational thought about what did I do?
Yeah.
You know, in AA, that's what we're taught to
ask.
That's
what you're sort of given to look for. How long is it since you had your last drink?
Now it's 4 years, 2 months,
Gary. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So, yeah.
And in that 4 years, things have changed
beyond
all measure.
Yes, and it's one of the things is that contentment with small things. You know, nature, just looking at a flower, the sunset. There doesn't have to be drama anymore. It doesn't have to be raging excitement off to nightclubs, drinking at the champagne bar at Euston. I'm happy with, you know, I can get great pleasure just from simple conversations, a simple cup of tea, and I love it.
It's absolutely brilliant. Again, we've asked everybody to choose a song, and you've chosen a track by Tom Walker. Tell us about it and tell us what it means to you.
I think what it means to me on a personal level is that my family, my husband in particular, didn't give up on me. You know, even over years we're talking, and was very forgiving. So he left a light on. But on a wider scale, I think what it also means is, you know, in this song, you have to go to the lighthouse. Alcoholism is a disease that tells people we don't have it. And that's the problem. The lighthouse is always there.
Yeah.
But there's only those small windows where we suddenly get some insight, and the alcoholic thinks, maybe there's a way out of this. And that's the time to just rush to the lighthouse. It's always there. And for me, it's AA.
It's always there for you. It's been brilliant. So I could talk to you both all night, but with four more people, to meet four more incredible people, Wendy and John, thank you so much. 21 years and more sobriety between you, and here's to another 21 and many, many more.
Thanks,
it's BBC
Gary.
Radio Lancashire. This is Tom Walker for Wendy. Leave a light on.
The second someone mentioned you are all alone, I could feel the trouble coursing through your veins. Now I know it's got a hold. Just a phone call left unanswered had me sparking now. These cigarettes won't stop me wondering where you are. Don't let go, keep a hold. If you look into the distance, there's a house upon the hill, guiding like a lighthouse. It's a place where you'll be safe to feel our grace, cause we've all made mistakes. If you've lost your way, I'll leave the light on. What's been on your mind? Lately you've been searching for a darker place to hide. That's alright. But if you carry on abusing, you'll be robbed from us. I refuse to lose another friend to drugs. Just come home, don't let go. If you look into the distance, there's a house upon the hill, guiding like a lighthouse. It's a place where you'll be safe to feel our grace, cause we've all made mistakes. If you've lost your way, I'll leave the light on. I will leave the light on.